It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later on Central Time, we'll talk about the tech startups that are trying to revolutionize the way we pay for things. Our guest says they could spell the end for credit cards as we know them.
First, on the day after a budget deal was reached in Washington, the Obama administration announced that nearly 100,000 Wisconsinites could lose access to long-term unemployment benefits unless Congress takes action.
And Congress has expressed some concerns about extending the program. So what does this mean for unemployed workers here in Wisconsin?
Joining us now is Laura Dresser, Associate Director of the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. Laura, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what does it take for someone to qualify for the extended unemployment benefits? How long do they go? When do they kick in?
Well, the extended unemployment benefits the program started in 2008 under George Bush. And it happens basically every time we have an economic meltdown when unemployment rates go up and people end up unemployed for a long time. First, they use up their state benefits, and then they usually the federal government has an extended program that adds on the extra weeks of unemployment benefits. There's different tiers depending on your state's unemployment rate, how many extra benefits you qualify for, and Wisconsin actually just moved from the maximum tier into a kind of middle tier. But workers that hit the end of their benefits December 28th in Wisconsin, and there's about 24,000 of those workers, would not qualify for the 14 more weeks of benefits that they would qualify for otherwise if they do extend this.
And then others later on, not at that December 28th deadline?
Right, because other workers will hit the end of their state benefits later, and so that's when they would be picking up the federal benefit. Anyway, so that number across the next year, the next 2 years, would be 100,000 workers who didn't get extended benefits, but the December 28th number is about 24,000.
And you mentioned these benefits have been in place since George W. Bush signed them in 2008. They've been extended a bunch of times since, but this was supposed to be a temporary measure, right? Is the economy recovering enough to where we're ready to not keep renewing these?
Well, this is the problem, or the elusive nature of this recovery. What we have in this recovery, we still have fewer jobs, just barely getting back to the level of employment we had in 2007. We have more workers in this labor market than we did then. This has been a very, very weak recovery. And so, yes, it's supposed to be a temporary benefit, but it's supposed to be a benefit as long as unemployment rates are high, and especially as long as long-term unemployment rates are high. And that's where we've seen the real increases. There's about twice as much long-term unemployment as there was before the recession. Those folks really need these benefits to make ends meet. And the economy really needs that money coming in and reinforcing in such a weak recovery. We need money coming in, and unemployment and benefits is one way for that to happen.
Two things I want to follow up on there. First of all, this chronic long-term unemployment. People have been writing a lot about that. Having been unemployed for a long time makes it harder to get a job. Companies are actually first clearing out resumes of people who are currently unemployed. Is this a new, tougher version of long-term unemployment?
Well, long-term unemployment is really difficult in the way you just say. The longer you're out of the labor market, the harder it is to get back in. The more employers, just use the unemployment as a sorting mechanism. Also, it's worth remembering that the unemployment is not kind of spread equally across the population. It's hit in specific economies where there have been massive shutdowns. So even in the state of Wisconsin, we have communities with very high unemployment. And so the extended benefits help those communities where workers are really struggling to find jobs. And in the background, remembering that we have fewer jobs today than we did 5 years ago, is another reason people are struggling to find jobs. But so have been for a long time. But yes, you're exactly right that when people come into that long-term situation, it just gets harder and harder to get out.
And then the other thing I wanted to follow up on, you mentioned briefly the economic benefit overall nationwide, and maybe in those hard-hit communities you mentioned, how important are these unemployment checks in keeping local and then the national economy growing?
Well, this is a critical aspect of federal stimulus. And in fact, because the national conversation is so focused on deficit reduction, this is one of the few places that works counter unemployment insurance works countercyclically. That is, money comes into pockets that need the money, that don't have the money when times are tight and when jobs are gone. And so this is directed to the very communities that need it most, the very households who have faced the hardest time in this economy, and it gets spent in those local communities, whether it's on rent or heat or food, and so it ripples through our economy in an effective way. An important stimulus to this still two-week recovery.
So the reason we're talking about this today is the deal reached yesterday by Congressman Ryan and Senator Murray. A lot of Democrats had been very hopeful that an unemployment benefit extension was going to be part of this deal. Some said it would be a non-starter if it wasn't part of it. Hey, were you hopeful that these unemployment benefits would be extended, or were you not surprised by what happened?
I guess I didn't know well enough the inside game to know whether I should be hopeful or not. But I do know that it's a disappointment that the deal was made between Murray and Ryan on improving what was, supposed to be unpalatable, the sequester. You know, that they found a way to improve that, I think, is good. But that they have left out unemployment, the long-term unemployed, is a real shame. And I hope something that the Congress manages to fix before they go home for their holidays in their warm homes.
In a sense, unemployment benefits, short or long term, are kind of a Band-Aid here for the problem of unemployment. Do you see other success stories in getting people back to work and off of these benefits so that they don't need them in the first place?
Well, the real question, I think, in terms of these benefits is about the health of the overall economy, not the kind of the individual situation so much as the general demand. What we need to see is stronger economic growth and the production of more jobs that will shorten the long lines that line up at every open job that exists and allow employers the ability to just be throwing out, resumes on the basis of how long folks have been unemployed. So what we really need is a lot more jobs, not, so much specific training programs at this point, although, training matters. But, in the context of this very weak demand, what we really need is some demand both on the private and public side to increase the number of jobs so that more and more people can get back to work.
And again, I know you don't have the inside scoop on what people in Congress are thinking, but do you think there's a shot that even though it's not in this budget deal, the White House and Congress might still do something to extend the longer-term unemployment benefits?
I know there are a lot of people inside and outside the Congress working on that issue, and there are a lot of there will be a lot of efforts around it, but I guess I will just have to keep my fingers crossed.
Laura, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Laura Dresser. She's Associate Director of the Center on Wisconsin Strategy.
Coming up after the break, we'll find out if credit cards, as we think of them now, are soon going to be a thing of the past. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. According to our next guest, the future of money has arrived, and it might not be what we're used to. He points out that cash is increasingly becoming obsolete, and if new technologies catch on, credit cards could soon follow suit.
Joining us now is Matt Vasilegambros. He is a staff correspondent at the National Journal. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
I want to start out with this whole cash is dead concept. Is that something that's happening all over the country? I mean, I still see plenty of it around.
Yeah, it's a concept that we're starting to see more and more in research. The people I talk to, it's a Chicago-based public relations firm called Walker Sands. They say that nearly 1 in 5 consumers don't even carry cash on them anymore, and a further 60% of consumers carry less than $20 in their pocket. And so they're seeing this trend of people not carrying cash in their pockets anymore and maybe relying more on credit cards or the technology that I talked about in this piece.
Yeah, and I want to get to that technology because I got to tell you, little insight here. I was so proud of myself when we were going to talk about the coin because I knew exactly what the Bitcoin was, and I was going to. But it's not the same thing at all. The coin is a totally different concept. So why don't you explain it for our listeners?
Sure. The coin, ironically enough, the future of money, as I call it. But the coin, it looks like a credit card. It's the size of a credit card. It swipes like a credit card, but it holds all the information of up to 8 different credit cards. And if you simply press a button on this little plastic piece, and it switches between your debit card or your credit card or your card for business, and it works just the same. And it's a product that only costs right now $50 or $100 when it comes out next summer. And they're promising that this will change fundamentally the way things work, and that you only have to carry this one simple thing in your pocket instead of all the credit cards and cash and everything. And it's a really interesting concept to me.
It is an interesting concept because you could take all your various credit cards, your Discover, your Visa, your Amex, whatever, your debit card, I assume, could be on there and
Absolutely.
All those things.
Yep.
And I like that. I sure like that flexibility, mm-hmm. but I don't like the part where I set something down and I walk away from it. And there's my 25 credit cards all sitting there far away from me, and I'm never going to see them again.
Except, though, there is the whole way that the only reason this works is there's a little Bluetooth technology, and every time that you walk away from your credit card, say you leave it at the, or your, excuse me, your coin, and you leave it at the restaurant, your phone will get a notification, it'll buzz, and it'll say, hey, you left your card, you know, you're far away from your coin right now, so you can walk back and go get it. The problem, though, is if your phone is off, you don't get that notification. And, you know, it's still just as risky in terms of all your information on one thing as a regular plastic card. And I think lest we forget that credit cards aren't necessarily a really tough concept, you know, to begin with. It's not really an inconvenience to carry a few credit cards in your wallet. So it's one of those old adages that, you know, that they're creating a solution for something that wasn't really a problem.
But it's a solution, you know, really, given the right zeitgeist and everything, it could really just catch on.
It really could. And I think we're seeing through different startups, whether you're talking about PayPal or the Google Wallet. There are several different digital startups, so these little companies of a few techies who have created this really revolutionary out there concept that are starting to catch on. And you can pay digitally now. You can just hit your phone somewhere and pay for everything. You don't need to pay your bills by sending a check in the mail. You can pay it online. You know, there's if you want a receipt, they don't print it out anymore. You can have it emailed to you. So there's a new trend of everything becoming more and more digital. And maybe there's a new trend of only carrying very minimal things in your pocket, like just this coin, and paying everything else online. So that's the future of money, as the people that I talked to said.
So the future of money may not be the coin, but it definitely or most likely will be something digital in nature. We don't exactly know what that shape looks like just yet.
Just yet, exactly. And it seems like the future of money is going away from these big credit card companies, that there's a lot of these smaller corporations that are giving businesses the opportunity to pay their bills or exchange money between businesses or exchange money with the banks through smaller digital means that don't necessarily cost as much money as a big credit card company will provide. So I think what's great about this startup culture that you're seeing throughout the entire United States, it's not just here where I am in Washington, but it's in Chicago right there or Des Moines, Iowa, or I'm sure in Wisconsin, of these small companies who are finding creative solutions that kind of, you know, buck the way things have gone through for many years. And so a lot of creative things are popping up, least especially the coin.
Now, when you talk about a small company, though, a small startup maybe based in Des Moines or Chicago or someplace like that, and they're going sort of, you know, head-to-head with credit card companies who are not particularly small and have lots of resources, are most of these startups just going to fall by the wayside? I mean, you know, it takes money to get something like the coin out there and into some sort of wide distribution.
That's exactly right. And they are so small, they don't have the money. And so coin right now is going out into the internet, you know, and they're asking people for money. They're looking to raise $50,000 right now. And, you know, if it's just six guys in some San Francisco office, you know, they can't afford that kind of capital. So many of these startups rely on crowdfunding, and it relies on, you know, people like you and me who, you know, just could donate a little bit of money, or maybe some big rich investor like Mark Cuban, you know, the owner of the Mavericks. And that's how startups like PayPal got started, or there's a new one in Washington and other places in the East Coast called Uber, and you can order a taxi on your phone. It's quite the service that we use out here, but it takes crowdfunding. It takes small donations from people because they can't, frankly, afford to do it otherwise. The credit card companies have just way too much money.
And, another thing that you mentioned Uber, and it reminds me that a lot of these ideas seem awfully abstract until you actually use them. You talk about the Uber concept and you use it to get a cab or a shared ride somehow, and then you use it and you're like, well, now that changes things.
It is. And it's I had the same reaction. I saw this. I'm like, oh, this isn't going to last. This won't work. And now I find that on weekends I'm relying heavily on this service. I guess that idea goes even further. You think about, you're at the Apple store and someone walks up to you with their iPad, and you just swipe your credit card on the iPad, and you have paid for all of your belongings without going up to a desk, and they email your receipt right there. I mean, that sort of concept of paying on a credit on an iPad, or going to a food truck, in the middle of town, and just paying right there without a credit card machine or anything, and it's done. I mean, that was crazy 2 years ago. So if you think about how much technology in terms of paying for things has progressed over the last couple of years, you can only imagine where it's going to go in the next couple of years. I mean, it's exciting to think about just because, the world is fundamentally changing in this respect, and I think that's quite exciting.
Now, we've been talking about this kind of from the consumer vantage point, but what about a business, a small business like a food truck, or maybe a large business like a, department store chain of some kind? Mm-hmm. What's in it for them to come up, to have to deal with yet another way to pay for something?
I think that it's more convenient for them. I mean, if you give stores and food trucks an easier way of going around, the red tape, I think that's brilliant. I mean, the square, this is what I was talking about. It's it's called the Square Reader. It's the size of a quarter, and it attaches to your iPod or iPad, and you can swipe someone's information, and it deposits directly into your bank account. And if you can do that without having to carry around the big bulky credit card machine and find an internet connection, I mean, I think that makes your business profoundly more efficient. I think it gives, in turn, the customers or the consumers a better business too, or a better experience as well, because it's just easier for them to check out, and you don't spend as much time checking customers out. You can get that quickly.
And, the thing about making things easier, though, is you also make, I think, that information more accessible when it's digital. And so for those folks who, who might want to take that information for some sort of nefarious purpose, doesn't that put your information more at risk than it may have been?
That's the elephant in the room here. So, the coin, while it does notify you that you're walking away and you're leaving it there, your information is still, on this card. People can still access it if they steal it. Bluetooth is not the most secure connection. People can
exactly.
tap into that Bluetooth connection. With any of these technologies, when I went home for Thanksgiving and I talked to my dad about this, when you talk about these small companies, they're very small companies. They might not have the security infrastructure that a credit card company might have. So there might not be the necessary steps that you need to take in order to make sure that your information is as secure as possible. So that's obviously the biggest risk here, is that they might not, while it's a great concept and they have a nice presentation, maybe their security is not as tested, because Coin is a company that's been around for 6 months, and it's going to be probably a year old by the time their product comes out. And, that might be disconcerting to some people.
So what do you think? In 5 years, 10 years, we'll be looking back at what used to be paper money in coins?
Yeah, I think that I think that we will have, currency, but I don't think that people will carry as much of it around. Just me personally, I rarely carry cash on me, and I think that people will find more and more ways of paying through their cell phone, and that will become more and more secure. I think in a few years' time, coin might be the norm, or there might be some new technology that makes the coin irrelevant. It's just the nature of technology.
It sure is. Well, Matt, thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me on.
Matt Basilagambros is a staff correspondent at the National Journal, and we've got a link to his piece if you'd like to read about it. It's called Cash is Dead, Are Credit Cards Next? And you will find that on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll be talking with a guest who says pride in Milwaukee is growing, but the city needs to have a community conversation about including more people in the city's future plans.
We'll also talk with an author who says the future of America will be more diverse and the era of the angry white man ultimately will be coming to an end.
And while it might be tempting to surprise a loved one with a cute puppy or kitty this holiday season, think twice before you do it.
That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, from Jay-Z to Al Gore, we'll be talking about the growing trend of going vegan in the U.S. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about what yesterday's budget deal could mean for hospitals right here in Wisconsin.
First, there's been a recent spate of public figures announcing that they're going vegan. Al Gore, Jay-Z, and Beyonce are just a few to announce in recent weeks.
Now, some people go vegan for health reasons. Others cite political reasons. But either way, it seems as though veganism is here to stay.
Joining us now to talk about going vegan and to take some of the mystery out of it is Ayende Howell. He's an executive vegan chef, founder of IEatGrass.com. Ayende, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, like we said in the intro there, there have been a lot of famous people going vegan lately. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, I think it's sort of a natural evolution for people. Once you've seen all the documentaries and you've sort of have the knowledge that the American food industry has been, you know, deceiving us for the past 50-some years, I think the natural next step for people is looking at their diet, how they can improve it, and then veganism has been around for, you know, such a long time that it's just a viable option, and it's becoming more and more of a viable option. The more people like myself who are involved and dedicated to making good food and not bad vegan food, which is highly key in the turnover of the vegans, you know what I mean?
So when celebrities, you know, like an Al Gore or a Jay-Z or somebody make these announcements, is that good for veganism as a whole, or do people look at that and say, oh, it's just a fad, it's just some crazy thing some crazy people are doing?
I think that it's good and bad, right? I think it's good because, you know, in my work, I travel a lot. I have a private client. She's a recording artist, so we travel around a lot, and I work in a lot of different hotels. And this time around, like, just saying, oh, I'm doing vegan stuff, or I'm cooking vegan food, I'm cooking tempeh or quinoa or sage, whatever the case may be, people were a lot more aware of what I was doing. So I think for the average American, celebrity often drives pop culture. So for it to be spoken from the lips of a celebrity or someone who, oh, I bought all their albums or I watched all their movies or so on and so forth, it makes them closer to the celebrity, which makes them closer to the lifestyle. But again, like, you can't just run up on the lifestyle. Like, you have to really sort of plot it out, because, like, you can't – for me, I would never go to a person and be like, okay, stop eating everything you've ever eaten. You've eaten all your life. You have to, like – it's slow. You know, there'll be somebody telling me, like, you can't eat tofu anymore. I'd be like, dude, I've been eating this all my life. Like, seriously, I can't. Just stop. Like, you have to wean yourself off. You have to find new textures and flavors and combinations and things that are going to be comforting to you. Because food is more than just what you eat. Like, food is about, like, how it makes you feel and what your mom made and what you had on your first date or Valentine's Day, you know. So there's so much more around food than just it being a fad or a diet. And I think that's the thing that makes it sort of out of people's reach, is like, how do I make it taste good?
You just mentioned you've been eating tofu all your life. You've been a vegan all your life. It wasn't as accepted a lifestyle probably when you were a kid. What kind of reaction did you get as growing up vegan?
Well, hence the name, I Eat Grass. I grew up in Tacoma, Washington, Pacific Northwest. And at the time, the word vegan wasn't even around. You just say, oh, I'm vegetarian, and people would look at you like you were growing another head in front of them. And I'm like, no, they're like, well, what do you eat? You know, like, you don't eat meat, you don't eat chicken, you don't eat ribs, what do you eat? You eat grass, ha, 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 ha. You know, so a lot of teasing, you know, there's a lot. I think that's the thing that's still the stigma around veganism still is that it's looked at as weird or sort of off-center, or like you can't go out with your friends and have a good time and be the vegan. I mean, I've been that guy all my life, you know. I go out, most of my friends aren't vegan. We go out, and it's like, okay, I scan the menu, edamame, hummus, veggie burger, you know, or I pack some snacks beforehand, you know. But the social aspect of it is really, I think, what needs some help and some attention. You know, I have some friends who have vegan kids these days, and they, you know, live in places like New York and San Francisco, so they're fine, you know. But getting outside of the coastal cities and into, like, middle America, I think it can still be a struggle because it's just about knowledge, you know, and being educated on where your food comes from, what it does, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, and that branches off into a bunch of different things, you know, food deserts and, you know, being able to get an understanding of agriculture to, you know, children in lower income areas so that they understand that a meal is not a bag of Cheetos. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And that getting that awareness out there had to be a big part of the impetus behind starting the website ieatgrass.com. So why did you start it? How's it been received?
I started I Eat Grass in 2010, and I started it because I was looking at the world and technology, and I just saw how everything was sort of being put into warp speed as far as technology and the way that we were receiving information. And I said, you know what, I got to get in on this thing. And I started my blog not really knowing, you know, what I was doing. And it has grown into an information hub for people. My Twitter account and my, which is at IND, AYIND, haha. in my iGrads account, what we do is we sort of give out information on that. I scroll the internet, and I have to be friends with work. We scroll the internet, and we figure out, like, okay, what sort of information can filter through the sustainability lens, through this sort of in a very tongue in cheek accessible way. Because my goal with iGrads from the beginning was to make it not 100% about just being vegan. It's about life too, because, you know, being vegan is a small part of your life. It's a big sort of, it's made to be a big part of your identity, I think, with, you know, the celebrities and whatnot. But it's a smaller aspect when you look at, you know, family and loves and movies and, you know, music and everything that you do on a daily basis. You know, you eat three times a day. So I want an iGrass to be a place where people can come, find good recipes, eat some good food, also learn, you know, read a review about their favorite movie, or they could also get some makeup advice or some fact advice or whatever the case may be. You know, it's lifestyle.
So are you trying
lifestyle through the lens of, like, this is how you do it, this, you know, in this new lane of sustainability and veganism.
Well, let's get into the food. You mentioned the recipes there. I would imagine, and personally, I think that sometimes one obstacle to eating less meat is we don't know how to cook without it. And the idea is that without meat, and especially here in Wisconsin, without the dairy, food is going to be boring and bland. Make the case that food could still be interesting without the animal products.
Well, what you have to do is you have to sort of look at food and recipes and culinary arts, they're ancient arts. They've been around. I mean, people were eating bread in the Bible. So they were also eating meat. But what you have to do is sort of look at the different areas that you can pull from. The grain kingdom, you know, there's tons of grains that you can use that have great textures and that are nutritious. You look at legumes. Garbanzo beans or chickpeas, which are used, hand over fist in places like the Middle East. You look at regular beans that are used in South America and in the Caribbean and so on and so forth. Soybeans, tofu, tempeh, seitan, which was developed hundreds of years ago by Buddhists because they have areas of the year where they don't eat meat and they wanted something to have like a textury a texture equivalent to what they were eating. And seitan is a wheat gluten product. So the thing that you have to look at replacing to your senses is going to be the texture. A lot of people will say, oh, I think it's going to be mushy because it's vegan. And it can be. There's some mushy vegan food, I'm not going to lie. But when you get to making the case for good vegan food, You have your grains, you have your legumes, and you move to the herb kingdom. There's tons of really delicious herb combinations and spice combinations you can come up with that are off the regular salt, pepper, butter, sugar sort of area of average, you know, cooking, which is sort of based on French technique. But the more that you get into other worlds, if you will, you know, I pull from an international palate. I want to know what people are cooking with in, you know, Thailand. I want to know what people are cooking with in Brazil. I want to know what herbs they're using and spices they're using in Morocco. I want to know all these things so I can sort of have this large palate so that when you taste my food, you're not tasting meat. You're tasting something new. You're getting the texture, you're getting the flavor, and you're getting the herbs, and it all is available from the earth.
So when people are first trying something vegan, does there have to be a shift in their palate? You know, if you're coming from a meat-based or a fat-based diet and you try something vegan right away, I think the impulse for a lot of people is like, well, that's not where I'm at. I mean, does there have to be a shift in the way they sense, the way they taste that food?
Yes, there has to be. You have to be open-minded. I think that's what I've come to find with dealing with clients and so forth. People will, and it's interesting because a lot of times I will get clients who are either recovering from cancer or have had some chemotherapy or have cancer, or, you know, they've been to their doctor and they're what I call being sentenced to veganism. And they've been, and they can't quite figure out what they're going to do. So that opens the mind in one way. It's hard to break old habits, though, for people. So people who are accustomed to a heavy meat, cheese sort of diet, my activism is let me cook up some food I think you might like. And you might like it, you might not. I mean, I spent over, you know, 12 years of my career working in restaurants, so I get a pretty quick reaction on what's going to sell and what's not going to sell. And I feel like I always have something in my wheelhouse that I can give even the most hardened, you know, meat and potatoes guy and have him be like, oh, okay, I didn't know that. Because it's almost like an elevation of consciousness. Like you have to understand it before you can actually believe it. And the only way that you can really show and prove with anything in the arts is you have to do it. You know, culinary arts, acting, music, whatever, you do it. And then they'd be like, oh, I never thought about it like that.
We're talking with Chef Ayinde Howell about the rise of veganism, and we'd like to hear from you. Are you a vegan? What influenced your decision to become one? Or are you just looking for ways to cook with maybe a little less meat, get meat and dairy out of a couple meals a week, looking for some ideas? Are you cooking for vegans this holiday season, looking for ideas, or just have questions for our vegan chef? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email at talk@wpr.org.
We'll pick up that conversation right after the break.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're picking up our conversation with Chef Ayinde Howell about going vegan. And you can join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. If going vegan is something you've thought about, if it's something you've done, give us a call. Tell us how it went for you. You can also post comments, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page. Our phone number, again, 800-642-1234. 1234. Andy, one of the big questions that I often hear about veganism revolves about that idea of protein intake. You know, where does the protein come from? And you're going to have all sorts of problems. How do you respond to that?
The protein question. Wow. Okay, so you can get protein from all areas of the plant kingdom. You can get it from beans. You can get it from tofu. You can get it from tempeh. You can get it from wheat protein. You can even find it in vegetables. You can find it. I wrote an e-cookbook on just using avocados because avocados are one of the only foods that have the 18 essential amino acids to create protein within the body. So there's a lot of ways where you can get protein. I haven't run into anyone with a protein deficiency. Now, I started to increase my workout regimen a little bit more. So there are times in your diet that you need to increase your level of calories overall, your protein, your carbohydrates, your sugars, and so on and so forth, if you want to do something different with your body. But the average meal is probably going to cover you. The thing that happens, though, when people go vegan is they just stop eating everything. Again, it comes back to like not being fully educated on how to find these things. It's like, well, I just don't want to eat meat anymore. Like I read skinny, I don't know if I can say that word. it's a book called Skinny Bleep. But there's a, you know, I've read this book or I've, you know, watched this documentary and I don't want to eat meat anymore. But they don't know what else to do. So it's like, I just had salads and I had, you know, popcorn. You know, obviously that's not going to be healthy for you. Again, where IEGRASS comes in, or Google in general, you could just, you know, sort of search, how do I replace, you know, protein here and there. So it's easy to do. It just takes a little bit of research, a little bit of question asking, and a little bit of sort of structuring of your diet and your food intake. And it's, and you'll be fine.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We have Mark with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Mark.
Hello there.
Hi,
Mark. Thanks for taking my question. First of all, about proteins and amino acids, just a real quick comment. You know, quinoa, the green quinoa has become much more popular, and it does have all nine of the essential amino acids. And secondly, no vegetable or few vegetables have all of the amino acids, but combinations as simple as beans and rice will give you all nine amino acids. My question, though, was I'm a vegan. I've been doing a vegetable-based diet for a long time, and I just decided to go completely vegan a few months ago, and I'm struggling with trying to figure out the best way to get enough vitamin D in my diet. And being in Wisconsin, you can't get out in the sunshine very much, especially when it's like 4 degrees.
Like it is now. Mark, thanks for the call. So he says quinoa or rice and beans for the protein, but where, given our limited sunlight, do we get the vitamin D without the animal products?
Well, you have to go to supplements. You can find vitamin D supplements on the shelf in your local, probably pharmacy, Rite Aid, or whatever the case may be that you have there. But vitamin D supplements are not necessarily. I thought he said B, which is something that people, vitamin B complex, which is something that people always ask about as well, which you should supplement in your diet. I always recommend to people that you should see a nutritionist. Nutritionist before you start a full vegan diet, so you can sort of, you have to understand what your body needs. My body needs something, your body needs something, the caller's body needs something completely different. He may need more iron, he may need more B, he may need more vitamin D, he may need more vitamin C. I don't know, but as sort of speaking in a broad sense, supplements can always fill in that gap. And yes, quinoa is great. Quinoa and rice and beans is great. I use quinoa a lot with my gluten-free clients because it's a complex carbohydrate. So it has your protein and your carb in it right there. And it's a great energy source, too.
All right, 800-642-1234. We've got lots of folks who would like to join in. And we go to Madison now, and Mike is with us. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment. About a year ago, I started switching my diet over to being vegetarian, and probably within the last 3-4 months, switched over to being about 90% vegan.
Congratulations.
It's really done tremendous. It's done tremendous things for my health. I've lost lots of weight. I feel really, really good, you know, and my wife is on, you know, more or less the same diet as well. And it's done great things for her. We've got 3 kids. They're not necessarily on, you know, entirely on board with, you know, being vegetarian or certainly vegan. So we, you know, we kind of have to split the household, but certainly some things have changed. It's really put a positive footprint in our household and in our lifestyle, you know, all the way around. So it's, you know, food is at the center of so much, and it's really impacted us, you know, beyond the kitchen table.
Mike, thanks so much for that call. And I end it, you know, Mike tells an interesting story there, and you do hear about those situations, you know, where one part of the family goes vegan, another part of the family isn't quite on board with that. How do you deal with those sorts of internal struggles? Because, you know, in families, that's where you're going to run into all sorts of resistance and all sorts of things.
I think when you have, like, a split household, you have to – it's funny. I know this from a dating perspective. Most of the women I've dated have not been vegan. So, you know, it's about respecting the other person's choices and supporting it. I mean, when you live with someone, obviously it's very close quarters. And, you know, if someone says, oh, well, I want to use my skillet for this, and I, you know, you use your skillet for chicken and so on and so forth, then, you know, it's really about listening to the other person and making sure that you support them in their decision. And, you know, the person who is vegan, you know, the more that they work at it and come up with better recipes and tastier food, if they're trying to, you know, woo that partner or child or whatever over to their side, you know, it works by example. But I know that there's actually a couple of cookbooks out that I think it's called slipped my mind. But I'll find it and I'll tweet it to you. But there's a gentleman who wrote a book. He has a house of, you know, vegetarians and omnivores and so forth, and he wrote a cookbook about it. I thought was quite inspiring. But again, it just comes down to being committed to your decision. You know, it's hard when you're divided at the dinner table because you're sitting across from someone who's like clearly making another choice about their life than you are. And when it really boils down to it, you are what you eat. And eventually, like a lot of my friends who are in their 30s and whatnot, they are coming to me now saying, Allende, I'm overweight, man. I gotta try this vegan thing. You know, send me some recipes, send me some ideas. You can't really escape the ramifications of processed food. So it's best to start to sort of wean it out and then get yourself on the right path so that when you're in your mid-30s or your 40s, that it's not playing catch-up, like you're just maintaining. That's what I'm finding. I'm 35. So,
thanks to Mike for the call. We've got Frank in Milwaukee on the line now. Frank, hi.
Hi. I was calling because I've given up dairy because of allergy reasons. But the thing with I've experimented with trying to be more vegetarian or give up meat, and I've tried the Boca burgers, I've tried the meatless sausages, and I have to eat a lot of it in order to get satisfied, and even if I do that, it seems like I get hungry quick right away. I was wondering if there's something out there that really can satisfy my appetite as opposed to what I've been trying.
Gotcha. Frank, thanks for the call. Allende, do we just get used to it, or is there something he could be doing to feel a little more satisfied as he's making the transition?
Well, if you're transitioning from, again, a largely sort of protein and carbohydrate diet, then you do consume a lot more carbs as a vegan. The thing that I would say, so let's say he's having some vegan sausage and peppers or something that he's prepared. A great way to sort of boost that is put it over a bed of quinoa, add some sliced avocado. What else could you do to it? I mean, those things are not necessarily bloat filling, but they will, that's, you know, you're tripling down on your protein intake, you're also adding carbohydrates, you know, you're adding things that your body will need and convert to energy, and you may have to eat more. I mean, you know, if he's a bigger guy, you know, you may have to eat more, and then eventually your stomach adjusts and it will sort of shrink down to the size that you know, it needs to be. Your body is whatever it needs to be at any given time with the food that you give it. So if you give it, you know, less food over time, and you're like, okay, well, we don't need all this extra space here. We're just going to shrink it down a little bit.
Andy, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your advice today.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me. I'm a big fan.
That's Allende Howell. He's an executive vegan chef, founder of IEatGrass.com.
Coming up next, we'll talk about what yesterday's budget deal on the federal side could mean for Wisconsin hospitals. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.